There, do you have any idea what you're listening to?
London Philharmonic?
It's Venus.
Huh?
Venus.
Why not? We bounced signals off the moon's surface. There's no reason that Venus shouldn't radiate impulses.
I don't mean the static. Can't you hear it, the other thing?
What other thing?
Listen to it, Paul. Listen to the voice.
Hello and welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Rees-Manillen. I'm your host. On today's program, trading cards of media heroes. We'll be talking to Jonathan Lawson from Reclaim the Media about their new series of trading cards honoring the heroes of media reform, media justice, media freedom, and freedom of speech. You do want to stay tuned. Well, before we get to our feature about media heroes trading cards, first a little bit of Media Geek headline news. These are stories which typically get covered only in the business pages, if they get covered at all, are treated as if they're only of importance to making money, trading stocks, and making investments. But I think these media stories are important to our democracy and our ability to communicate freely and work for justice. And this week, it's mostly about the internet. That's a pretty important way to communicate. And last week, I discussed a report from the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development that shows the U.S. trailing most leading developed nations when it comes to broadband internet deployment. Comes in number 15th in the world now, falling back from where it used to be at number 4 just a couple years ago. Now, I've certainly not shied away from expressing my criticism of this sorry state of affairs and have no problem laying that blame squarely at the feet of the telecom industry and the regulators who keep giving them the so-called relief they ask for without ever holding them truly accountable for their promises to roll out more and faster broadband. Well, on May 29th, the Wall Street Journal's influential technology columnist, Walt Mossberg, laid into FCC Chairman Kevin Martin with a similar complaint. During a panel discussion at the D, All Things Digital, conference, Mossberg complained to Martin that, quote, we are very slow, end quote. And slow, that means broadband. Then the following exchange ensued. The whole story, I think you do have to put in the context some of the demographics of the United States and some of the countries we are competing against, end quote. Mossberg says, quote, does that explain why we pay $12.50 per megabit in the United States as opposed to $3.09 in Japan and $3.70 in France? Why are we paying four times as much? End quote. Martin answered, quote, yes, it does, because it costs a lot more to build out in some rural areas and people who live further apart. We have a history of averaging some of the cost to make it affordable for people in Montana, end quote. Now, also at the conference, Martin continued to shop around his latest plan that the U.S. government should subsidize broadband network construction. He argues that broadband is an important network, as important as telephone, and should be treated similarly, noting that telephone network construction has been subsidized for decades. Now, I got to look at that, and I think, sure, it was subsidized. It was also a monopoly. And it was also highly, highly regulated by the United States government. I find it ironic that Chairman Martin would like to see internet treated like telephone with regard to government subsidy, a basic government handout, government welfare for these wealthy corporations, when he doesn't otherwise want internet to be treated like telephone when it comes to common carrier protections and network neutrality, since he voted quite heartily to take common carrier protections away from the internet, which allowed, therefore, and opened the floodgates for the likes of Comcast to begin blocking traffic from file sharing programs like BitTorrent, and has raised the specter of network neutrality. We wouldn't be arguing about network neutrality if common carrier provisions were still applied to the internet and therefore was treated end-to-end as a neutral network as telephone is. If we're going to have the subsidy going to these large companies, shouldn't there also be the public interest there? But, you know, as I mentioned last week and will continue to mention on this program, dating back to the mid-90s, dating back to the Telecom Act of 1996, and to lots of state laws that got passed in the late 90s, early 2000s, the telecom industry was handed regulatory relief and all sorts of other incentives time and again in exchange for their promise that they would roll out broadband. And that we'd be seeing things like fiber to the home with hundreds of megabits of speed by like the turn of the century. Certainly way before now. It's 2008 and most of us are still getting over copper wire, either cable or through DSL. We're lucky to see a megabit to a megabit and a half of speeds here in 2008. Meanwhile, I don't see why AT&T can't be investing back in that network. Profits of just the first quarter in 2008 were $3.5 billion, up 22% from the first quarter of 2007. Now, a lot of that does come from their wireless service, which, of course, they brought together and acquired when they acquired SBC in a $65 billion deal. How much broadband deployment was $65 billion buy? That's my question. Which was fast-tracked and green-lighted with almost no provisions, with almost no riders on it by both the Justice Department and the FCC. I would call that a massive handout. I would say that basically equals a subsidy, allowing these companies to gobble up other companies and get bigger, spending billions of dollars, billions and billions and billions of dollars to do it. I would say the subsidies already been given. And when we just look at the retired CEO of AT&T who received a package, a retirement package of $158 million. That's Ed Whitaker. $158 million. Now, it doesn't quite equal the amount of deployment, about $6 billion a year, that Kevin Martin says is currently spent on deploying broadband networks in the United States. But I really wonder how much broadband network would $158 million buy? And just the $18 million, which Ed Whitaker saw per year in overall compensation. And so it's nice to hear the FCC chairman put broadband internet rollout high on the list and to start considering other ways of doing it and possibly looking at it from the standpoint of the public interest. Although I'm not sure how you might feel about municipal broadband, since that's been something when communities have tried to do it, get staunchly knocked down and lobbied against by the likes of AT&T and the likes of Verizon. If we're going to subsidize broadband, well, then why should we be giving that subsidy straight over to AT&T to put into its coffers? Why not just use that same subsidy for municipalities, counties, and states to roll out broadband too? There's a lot of ways to skin that cat. But at the same time, through all this, we still got slow speeds. And speaking more about your internet and maybe how you get charged for it. We're used to metered water, gas, electric, and cell phone minutes. Are we ready for metered internet? Time Warner Cable is going to try it out in Beaumont, Texas. Beginning June 3rd, new subscribers in that city will have a monthly data allowance. Customers who go over that limit will be charged $1 per gigabyte. Time Warner says the idea is to attempt to deal fairly with the big variances in internet usage from customer to customer, where 5% of subscribers take up half the company's local capacity. Of course, the poorly kept but dirty little secret of broadband service is that most providers already have a usage cap on their so-called unlimited service, but the rub is that they don't publish what the cap is. So if you're a Comcast customer, go ahead and give it a shot. Call up your local Comcast provider, your local cable franchise, and ask them, as a broadband customer, at what point will they shut off your service after you've downloaded how much? And see if they'll give you an answer and tell you exactly what that moment will be. But then in Beaumont, Texas, Time Warner's move to metered broadband at least will make that cap known. It'll range from 5 gigabytes a month for its basic $30 a month service to a 40 gigabyte a month cap for its $55 a month service. for basic web browsing, email, and maybe even some music downloading. A lot of customers won't see extra charges ever. But you know, once you get into the video realm, just a few movies from the iTunes Music Store can very easily put you over that 5 gigabyte limit. And you may approach that 40 gigabyte limit with just a bunch more YouTube usage or Hulu.com usage. And so, I would say, as an observer, as someone who's been watching this, I prefer truth in advertising when it comes to broadband service. I'd certainly like to know what my limit is and what I'll be charged, rather for it to be an unknown quantity, where I may at any time, if I'm a big user, see my service stopped or suspended because I've downloaded too much. And the whole idea that maybe you do pay for usage doesn't seem too onerous to me, actually. Because it should mean then that people who have very minimal needs, someone who really only wants to do email and social networking sites and doesn't care about video, ought to be able to get a really inexpensive package. Maybe $5, $10 a month that'll cover all their needs. And if you really do want more, I don't see a big problem with paying more. And that really resolves a lot of these issues. However, I look at these rates that Time Warner wants to pay, at $1 a gigabyte a month, and that actually seems pretty expensive to me. That seems a little more expensive than it ought to be. I think their limits are awfully low, and at 1 gigabyte per month, that adds up pretty quickly. That means for any given movie that you might download, whether standard def up to high def over your basic limit, you're basically adding a $1 to several dollar tax to that movie. And I think that's the way we want to look at it, because Time Warner Cable, their primary business, is television and offering new advanced television services, video on demand, and other things over that same cable line using broadband internet-like network technologies. So I think that those limits that they've placed at 5 gigabytes and 40 gigabytes are indeed exactly aimed not at file sharing, not at BitTorrent, not at people downloading other things, but aimed right at that burgeoning and soon to explode online video rental and download market, to basically place a great disincentive to using those download services, whether it's from Amazon or iTunes or Netflix, rather than using the AT&T service. They're trying to basically say, we're going to tax you for that by charging you significantly more dollars per movie when you won't get that same surcharge if you choose to get that video on demand movie from your AT&T cable, even though the amount of weight it puts on the network will be about the same or more. It's just going to be AT&T's weight. So as it still looks now, while it's certainly fairer than not knowing how much you're going to be charged, I really can't quite endorse this approach because at this point, they're clearly looking to be punitive with regard to placing the limits way too low in a way that I think is very unreasonable. And for someone like me, who actually does a lot of media production on the internet, do my show, upload and would like to be doing more video, frankly, and uploading and downloading things. It could end up costing me a lot compared to what I was accustomed to paying, even if I'm not really taking up the kind of bandwidth that perhaps someone, a heavy BitTorrent user, is taking up. Of course, Time Warner is free to experiment with its pricing schemas. Certainly, even in the phone era, phone usage was metered and is metered still. Regular plain old telephone service is a metered service where you pay per minute for long distance and local in a lot of cases. And competition in that realm has often driven those prices down, especially in long distance. So truly, one of the great solutions to a pricing scheme you don't like from a provider like Time Warner will be competition, will be other providers not charging the same or charging less or charging a different rate structure. And as I pointed out many times on the program, one of the big problems with broadband in the United States is the lack of competition, in that in a lot of cities, you'll simply have your cable provider like Time Warner and a telephone provider like AT&T or Verizon. And you won't see a lot of price differential between their rates because there isn't a great deal of incentive for a price war in a market where there's only two players. Nevertheless, if it turns out that cable subscribers in Beaumont, Texas really hate the limits and this pricing move by Time Warner. They will probably not subscribe, or they will end their subscriptions and go to whatever the competitor is there in Beaumont. And that may speak to Time Warner, or in a worst case scenario, the competitor will adopt a similar pricing scheme and giving you nowhere to hide. So that's a bit of what's going on in our media environment and with regard to the internet, one of the most important communications media that we have in the United States and in the world. And I talk about it because that is the way that independent media is getting around. It really was a boon to independent media to have the internet and to have the ability to transport audio, video, photos, and just plain text. And our ability to continue to pursue independent thought and to broadcast really independent thought relies on the internet, and it continued to be free and continue and relying on it being priced in a way in which nearly everyone can afford and can afford to be true participants on the internet, to not merely be consumers, to not merely be viewers, but also to be sharers, to be producers, to use the internet to reach a larger audience and to get outside your geographical boundaries in ways that you can't easily do otherwise. That's what I want to see preserved, and that's why I keep covering it here on Media Geek. And that is the name of the program. My name is Paul Rees-Mannell, and I am your host. It is the weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as that critical examination of our media environment. You can check out Media Geek online at MediaGeek.net. It's the home of the Media Geek blog, going strong after 8 years on the internet. And of course, you can download the program at radio.mediageek.net. You can subscribe to the podcast or listen to it in your browser, all at MediaGeek.net. If you have any comments about the program, please send them to me, paul@MediaGeek.net. The weekend of June 5th brings the National Conference for Media Reform to Minneapolis, Minnesota, where many modern-day progressive media heroes will be on the stage, on the dais, and in the audience, working together in this growing movement for media justice, for better media democracy. Reclaim the Media is an organization that's been at it for 6 years now, beginning in 2002, headquartered in Seattle, Washington, and mostly focusing on the Northwest, but also focusing on national and global issues of media reform and media justice. And they want to highlight some of the media heroes you might not have heard of, people who've blazed that trail for media democracy. So Reclaim the Media's Jonathan Lawson tells us more about that.
This is an idea that Reclaim the Media has been kicking around actually for several years. Not so much with, well, both the idea of doing something fun like trading cards for media heroes instead of for sports figures or whatever, but more generally than that, the idea of just as a movement celebrating our ancestors, the people that have been doing amazing work for decades and even centuries. There's been radical media and media activism going on for way longer than the past few years lifespan or memory span of the progressive movement, and we wanted a way to celebrate that history and also to inspire new activists to say, look, people can do these things in all kinds of social conditions, and there's such a breadth of experience in radical media activism and education. So we wanted to celebrate that in a way that would be fun as well as informational.
And so looking at this list, I see names that I know and I'm very familiar with. And I actually see names that I'm not so familiar with. Are there anybody you want to pick out and highlight here that people might not be so familiar with?
Well, that was our intention. We wanted to grab people that would make the cards attractive immediately and provide people with some touchstones. A lot of people are familiar with somebody like Frederick Douglass already, as an amazingly important American historical figure. But maybe folks don't know that, it was an important aspect of his career that he was a journalist, that he born a slave and came out of captivity and got his political education from reading and then working for William Lloyd Garrison's newspaper, The Liberator, and then moved on to start his own paper, The North Star, and that was really his vehicle for becoming a well-known political figure and a speaker. And there are folks whose accomplishments are such an important part of our contemporary media landscape, like Reverend Everett Parker from the United Church of Christ, who was a civil rights activist in the 60s. Martin Luther King enlisted his help to find something to do about these racist television stations in the Deep South that were basically whitewashing coverage of the civil rights movement. And wasn't there something that could be done about that? Everett Parker designed a strategy to do media watching, to do monitoring of the racist TV stations down there, and then to take it to the FCC and say, look, these stations have an obligation to the public interest. At the time, this idea that the citizens could go to the FCC and say, hey, we have a right to challenge these stations that are not benefiting us, that was not an idea that had any currency at the FCC. And in fact, it took a prolonged court case, which Everett Parker and the UCC pursued, to actually get that right. There's so many heroes from different generations and different situations. The muckraking journalist Ida Wells, the public access producer Dee Dee Hallock, the educator Gene Kilbourne. There's so many people. And it was really hard to choose only 21, I can tell you that.
We should have gone for 52. We made it like a deck of cards.
We could do that. I mean, we could have done that immediately, actually. I mean, there thinking up a list of heroes was very easy. We had a process that involved a bunch of people in it, but then narrowing that down to 21 was painful, and we just had to eventually throw up our hands and say, well, you know, this is going to be pretty subjective, and everybody who sees this list of heroes is going to immediately say, well, how come this person is on the list, and so forth. And so we're ready for volume two.
And so did you prepare these so that you would have them ready for the Media Reform Conference coming up here very quickly in Minneapolis?
That'll be their public debut. We've been working on these for several months now. Actually, we've been trying to do this for a couple of years. We just got all the pieces in place to be able to do it. But yeah, they'll make their first public debut at the Media Reform Conference in Minneapolis. And then probably also at the at the Ally Media Conference in Detroit later this summer.
And thinking about this concept, what I find kind of amazing is that we can think about there being media reform heroes now in this day and age, and that there is a coherent movement where we can think about where we are now and concepts of like being able to, as citizens, petition the FCC and file complaints to the FCC and expect some degree of attention and action. And that, you know, there's been all these years in this platform that's built up. Reclaim the Media in the last 6 or so years has been part of that as well. Maybe you can tell us just a little bit about your organization and what you've been doing.
Sure. I'm going to say something about the idea of media movement. As you know, it's been sort of slow progress over the past, 5 or 6 years that you and I both have been working on these kinds of issues and seeing the interest and activism around media issues, rise significantly in the public mind over that period of time. And I think it does make sense for a lot of people now to talk about a media reform movement or a media justice movement or a media democracy movement. I think that the definition and the boundaries of what that means are still pretty up in the air, which is a good thing, I think, a healthy thing. And one of the things we wanted to do with this set of cards, as this is a strategy for Reclaim the Media and our allies in the movement as well, is to try to expand the concept of who's involved with this kind of work and who are our allies. You know, it's people who are, might consider themselves primarily educators or journalists or social justice activists or feminists or whatever, but it's all part of this big puzzle. To answer your question about Reclaimed Media, we've been at it in the Northwest since 2002, which is our founding conference, and we kind of work along three threads of our work, and this set of cards kind of straddles the line a little bit. We do media policy advocacy. We also do media literacy education in a whole bunch of different venues, working with schools, also working with progressive organizations and churches and whatever. And then we also work with community media, helping community radio networks and other forms of community media, public access television, do what they do better and get networked and learn how to view their community of listeners and viewers as a political constituency for expanding communications rights. And we're members of a national coalition of regionally based groups like ourselves called the Media Action Grassroots Network, which is comprises groups in Seattle, Oakland, Minneapolis, Albuquerque, Philadelphia, and Whitesburg, Kentucky. I don't think I left anybody out there. Oh, in New York. And we're all working to bring together media democracy and media reform concerns with the longer-term struggles for social justice, fighting racism and sexism, and making our democratic system work more effectively for everyone, and recognizing that media plays such a crucial role in that struggle. We'll be at the Minneapolis conference in solidarity with those folks in the Magnet and distributing these cards.
And so getting the cards, I guess you can get them at the Media Reform Conference. Is there any other way that they can be had?
Well, the most fun way to get them is directly from us at the Media Reform Conference or wherever. But yeah, we're distributing them on the web through our website, which is reclaimthemedia.org. And there's a special site for the cards and for the heroes, I should say, reclaimthemedia.org/mediaheroes. And for everybody who sees the list and says, hey, how come Noam Chomsky isn't on this list? How come Susan Stamberger isn't on this list or whatever? Then there's a place where they can actually submit their own hero right there, and that'll go on the website.
And your website is so much more than just a way to get your trading cards. Tell us a little bit about what's there.
Sure. We do a lot of policy, a lot of community media advocacy and activities in the Northwest. So there's a little bit of a Seattle Northwest focus to it. But we also have a daily updated newswire of issues affecting media, media democracy, communications rights, internet governance, community media, et cetera, a whole range of activities. And that gets updated every single day. And there's also a kind of a backlog of resources for media literacy education and just all kinds of stuff that's kind of accumulated over the last several years. And last but not least, links to a broad range of media organizations and progressive media blogs around the country. So wherever you are, there's you'll find links to activities near you on our site as well.
All right, Jonathan. Well, thanks for telling me more, and I hope you have a good time in Minneapolis. You get a lot of cards into people's hands, and it's good for all of us.
Thanks, Paul. Great talking to you.
That was Jonathan Lawson talking about the Media Heroes Trading Cards being put out by Reclaim the Media, and they debut at the National Conference for Media Reform weekend of June 5th in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And you can learn more about those cards and you can learn more about Reclaim the Media at reclaimthemedia.org. And that brings to a close this edition of Media Geek. I will be back in 1 week with more news and views in our media environment. So in the meantime, go to mediageek.net to read the Media Geek blog. At radio.mediageek.net, you can download this program. You can get the podcast or you can listen right there in your browser. It's all at mediageek.net. If you have any comments about the program, please send them to me, paul@mediageek.net. And Media Geek is currently produced in the neighborhood of Rogers Park in Chicago, Illinois. And the founding station is WEFT 90.1 FM in Champaign, Illinois. And it's carried on non-commercial and community stations around North America. Stations like Radio Free Moscow, KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, and KRBS in Oroville, California. And of course, cast it out via podcast at radio.mediageek.net. So I do appreciate you tuning in.